Welcome to the New Books Network.
Gilbert Grosvenor, who was the father of photojournalism, as well as president and chairman of the board of the National Geographic Society, had this to say about maps. Quote, "A map is the greatest of all epic poems. Its lines and colors show the realization of great dreams." Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. We hope you'll subscribe to our series on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm happy to welcome Riaz Din to the show today to talk about his new book, Mapping the Great Game, Explorers, Spies, and Maps in 19th Century Asia. Riaz Din is an engineer by profession and an independent scholar by choice. Riaz Din, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Renee, and good morning to you, all your listeners.
I love the idea of an independent scholar, a person who studies and learns, motivated merely by the love of learning. Tell us about that. What influenced you to follow that path?
I guess it stems from my love of books and maps. Particularly, I have two passions in that. The first is to read and learn about the exploration, particularly the exploration of Asia. And the other piece is around maps. I think I'm perhaps like some of the other readers, to hold a beautiful map is a wondrous thing. So I've always had that interest, and to now convert it to actually write a book and with a few other books in mind is very satisfying.
Was there someone or something in your life that strongly influenced your intellectual development?
That's interesting because I was born and really raised in Fiji, which, surprisingly, in our household, we had a lot of books and we all read a lot, including my father and my siblings as well. So I guess I've always had a thirst for learning. I think coming from a small place, we sort of really had a wide scope because we tended to look outside the outside world for our interests.
Well, this book focuses on the arc of countries around northern India, that is Iran, Afghanistan, Turkestan, and Tibet. What is the great game of your title? And how did it play out there in the 19th century?
Yes, so the great game, I guess, was a euphemistic term that was coined by the British. The Russians, by the way, had their own term, which was called a tournament of shadows. And what it underpinned was this the strategic rivalry during the 1800s for Central Asia. So the British had India, and it was their jewel in the crown. From an economic point of view, it really drove their wealth as well. While at the same time, the Russian Empire was growing, and they expanded outwards into Central Asia, what was then Western Turkestan, and they steadily colonized the countries that today we know as the Stans, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. And as they did that, the great game was in a way created because their ultimate goal was perhaps to take India as well. And that is something that the British would never allow. And so the battle lines were formed along that arc that you mentioned. And it was these buffer countries in that arc, particularly Afghanistan and Tibet, and north of the Oxus River, which today is the Amu Darya, that is where the great game was played out. And both sides pursued it vigorously, almost came to war on a couple occasions, but in the end were able to avert it. I think sounder heads prevailed.
It's somewhat shocking to our 21st century mind is the role played by what you call the tyranny of distance, the incredible amount of time it took to communicate between, for example, London and Calcutta. Tell us about how that impacted the course of events.
Yes, actually, that's a very important point in understanding why events unfolded as they did. You know, in the early 1800s, and when India was first colonized and being developed, because of the way the monsoons affected shipping, for example, a note from the British Parliament through to the administration in India could take many months, and by the time they replied, and that reply reached back home, could have been anything up to 2 years, because really the only way then was through shipping and notes carried through shipping. People could travel overland, but all through Central Asia, much of that was pretty dangerous territory and not easily navigated. So those early days, the British that were in India really made their own decisions. I mean, they needed to anyway, because they were there on the spot and events were changing quite quickly. But also they pursued their own interests as well. And, you know, it's well documented in history that a lot of the early British merchants and military people came out looking for their own personal gain as well too. So for them, conquest and I suppose getting very favorable deals was very much what drove them. Later on, once the Suez Canal was opened, then shipping through the canal meant that a message through to India, rather than take up to 2 years, was down to a matter of months. And then finally, I think it was in 1869 that there was a undersea cable that was laid between the two countries. And then, of course, communication was within a matter of hours and minutes.
It's really quite shocking to think about 2 years or even months of a gap, especially since you and I are separated by many thousands of miles. You're in New Zealand, I'm in Israel, and we're chatting as if we're in the same room. But what was the impact within the military and within the government decision-making when someone on the spot was not able to get direction from headquarters for months or even years?
Yes, that's right. So, in the English Parliament, the UK Parliament, there were really two camps. There were the hawks and the doves, and the hawks were all for expanding their territories and really pushing forward the empire, whereas the doves, in a way, their stance was, I suppose, derisively called masterly inactivity. And yet, whichever were in power, it was difficult for them to then influence what was happening in India because of this time lag. So, for example, if the doves were in power and they were all for they're just consolidating their gains and not focusing on territorial expansion, those wishes weren't necessarily enacted in India. And you could see, for example, when the whole Punjab was taken, or Sindh was taken, all the time the viceroy, well, actually, the powers that be in India anyway, in Calcutta, were pushing ahead with their own agenda. And the two weren't always aligned.
Tell us about the first British player in the great game, William Moorcroft.
Yes, William Moorcroft was a fascinating person, and he was unusual for a couple of reasons. One of them was, by the time he came to India, he was actually quite old for his age. At the time, many Europeans in Asia, really, had they been in Asia, were dead by that stage. Also, he was a veterinarian and a very good one at that. And the other thing that was, I guess, unusual about him was that he wasn't part of the British military. He worked for them and was their superintendent of stud for a big stud farm, because the cavalry were very short of horses and could not sustain and supply the number of horses that they needed. So when he came across and set up their stud, he did a lot to improve that. But then why he became famous was that he realized that his heart really lay in exploration. And as the first, as you say, the first great game player, he started to go north of India, into the edges of Tibet, and more importantly, into what was then Western Turkestan, and finally into Bukhara, where he was looking for the best bloodlines of the Turkmen horses. In doing that, he realized that the Russians were already into Central Asia, north of the Oxus, and so he was the first great game player, in a way, to sound the alarm to the British in India that, hey, there's another power that you need to be wary of.
So he discovered that, although he wasn't really looking for it, it wasn't his intention. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. He there's a famous story where he's in one of the villages and these dogs come out barking, and then he realized the dogs were Russian dogs, and that alerted him to the fact that actually in Central Asia, many, many miles from the Russian border and from Moscow, here were Russians already in the bazaars and seeking to stamp their influence. And of course, from Moorcroft's point of view, he felt that the British were better placed and in their own interests to expand into Central Asia. So he started to sound the alarm also that in the interests of defending India as well.
The one common error, at least I believe it's an error, in the way of thinking when we read or study history, is the tendency to judge the past by the values and perspectives of the present. How was colonial perceived in the 19th century, both by the major imperialist empires, Russia, Great Britain, Iran, and France, and by the colonized people?
Yes, that's a really good question, and I try to address that in the book as well. And I think particularly what I try to do in terms of talking about the great game when that colonization was in full swing in Central Asia, to try and keep an even hand. And what I mean by that was that all the powers were at it. And of course, amongst the Europeans, the British had taken India, which was, as I said, the jewel. And the Russians, for their part, was trying to take Central Asia because they really saw this on their doorstep and their area of influence. There was no question about the rights and wrongs then of colonization. And until you take that into account, it's sometimes difficult to see why the empires were expanding the way they were.
So the So that the expansionists never even considered that there could be any problem with colonizing other places?
I think generally not, especially in the earlier 1800s when colonization was in full swing. And I suppose sitting here in New Zealand, you know, I mean, the Pacific was colonized in the same way too. And, you know, at the time, it went through various stages, but early on, it was the great white, you know, civilizing influence, you know, followed on by the missionaries and you know, maybe a conversion to a true God, in inverted commas. But I think I also try and make the point that, you know, if we return to Central Asia, that it's unfair to think that the colonization was only bad. Because in many ways, the people who were colonized did benefit from, you know, from a rapid improvement in their living standards, in their education, in many respects like that. The thing also obviously is that looking back, you know, there was no choice. And I think things were as they were. You know, it's difficult to judge a century later sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Afghanistan is in the news every day now, and historically, it's been the downfall of many empires long before the 19th century, going all the way back to Alexander the Great and the Greeks. Why were they drawn to Afghanistan? Why was it always so important to the great empires of the time?
Yes, that's a point I try and explain carefully in the book and through the maps in the book as well, as the great game was played out. Because as the Russian Empire gobbled up Western Turkestan, you know, on its way perhaps towards India, there was little that not only Britain but the other European powers could do about it. And so in the end, the British decided to draw a line in the sand. And of course, the line in the sand had to be through a buffer country, because neither empire wanted to border each other in a way, because that is always, it creates its own flashpoints militarily. So the buffer drawn was Afghanistan, just as Tibet was later on, though it was not as important. And the other reason Afghanistan was so important was that coming through from Europe through to Central Asia, really the passes were through Afghanistan, the legendary Khyber Pass, but also the Bolan Pass as well, and that whole land bridge between Europe and the Near East, and then coming through the whole Persian land bridge, all those roads from Europe led to Afghanistan first before India. And so then Afghanistan, whether it liked it or not, all through the ages and even today, becomes a buffer country in some ways that is just fought over.
So that's its role today too, you're right. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm sure that's not what they want. And the other shame of it is of course, is that when you look at and you know, in my book I talk in great deal about the first two Afghan or Anglo-Afghan wars, which ended badly for the British, and yet the powers later on the Russians and then even the Americans and the coalition that went into Afghanistan, almost nobody seems to learn from those mistakes, you know, and a key one being that the Afghanis refuse to be ruled by other people. You know, they abhor having foreigners, you know, on their soil.
And they have a lot of experience with foreigners trying.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yes, all the way to Alexander the Great, as you say.
Yeah. Let's turn for a moment to the spies you mention in the title. I was surprised to learn from your book that despite perceiving Russia as a threat, the British were reluctant to use spies in India before 1829. Why was that, and what changed their minds?
Yes, that's right, actually. And there's been various suggestions, but the one that I talk about in the book is that the British actually weren't used to the whole concept of spying prior to that time. That's not to say that the Asians weren't. The Asians, I think, have been masters at spying, but the British in India weren't, and it's been suggested that there was really against their culture almost in a way, so that when the Great Game began, and the military powers then wanted all this information about Central Asia and what lay outside India's borders, working towards the borders of Russia, they realized that they just didn't have any of that material. They didn't have the maps, they didn't have the spy networks. You know, they didn't have people on the ground, and so that was something they had to fix urgently. They took to spying in that area out of necessity, rather than anything else.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what was the general state of mapping in the world at the beginning of the 19th century?
Yes. So really, the British and the French in Europe were particularly strong at mapping. And so the British, perhaps more than anyone else, whereas the French were very good at geodesy. And so then Britain was mapped through surveys that mapped all of Great Britain. And soon afterwards, Russia was beginning to be mapped in the same way. Because the British wanted to, tax and gain revenues from India, their need to map India was driven by this sheer necessity, because the simple fact being that you can't tax landowners until you know the extent of their holdings and until it's mapped. So then, again through need, India started to be mapped very quickly. And it wasn't long before, in the 1800s, where actually India was one of the best mapped countries in the world. And part of that was the creation of the Great Arc, which went through the whole length of India to measure the shape of the planet around the tropics and around India, which was the geodesy part of it that the French were so good at as well.
And in doing that, in surveying and mapping, it wasn't just the British, Europeans, and Russians who were involved in it. They depended, according to your book, on the local native Indians, especially the Pundits. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, the Pundits. Yes.
Pundits.
Yes. So what happened there, the British could map within the boundaries of India, without risk other than, of course, the, you know, the dangers they faced in the jungles and through disease and the difficulty they had just surviving in India. But really there was no external threat as such. The problem became was that for two reasons. One, the British were great explorers and they had this great thirst for exploration and they wanted to know what lay across the border from India, you know, whether it was into Central Asia or across the Himalayas and all the way into Tibet. So they had a real desire to map those countries as well, but those countries wouldn't let them in, particularly in Afghanistan, in Tibet, and into Central Asia as well. So the way they did that was to train native Indians to cross the border, which they could do without being barred into their country. And Tibet was a really good example of that. But also, they weren't suspected as being surveyors in any form. So the British came up with this idea that, well, if we train native Indians, which we call the pundits, they could walk into places like Tibet or into Afghanistan and map as they went along. In mapping, what we mean is really is to gather the data in terms of distances and direction to bring the data back into India where the British cartographers would then create those maps.
So they were able to enter the other countries without suspicion, but not without risk, I understand.
Oh, yes, that's right. I mean, for any of the pundits to be caught and to be found out as surveying in any form would have meant death. And you have to remember that the pundits needed to carry things like compasses and sextants. And later on, they carried even more sophisticated equipment like Android barometers and andrometers, where they could measure the topography of the country that they visited. And so it wasn't a matter of just being in disguise, but also hiding the equipment that they carried as well, too, including all their notes and the sketches they made.
Yes, and their equipment was not miniaturized as ours are today. They were big, clunky objects. So, yes. Do we know? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but on that... So what the British at the Survey of India's headquarters, what they did was they had a workshop and they would make these instruments so that they could be hidden, you know, in, for example, their baggage. And for example, the compasses they carried could be hidden in their prayer wheels and the notes were hidden in their prayer wheels. So there was a lot of spycraft involved, certainly.
So it sounds like the British got started a little late in spying, but they caught up pretty quickly.
Yes, that's right. And they just applied themselves well and, driven by that need.
Do we know the names of any of the pundits? Or are they sort of the unsung heroes?
Yeah, they are in many ways the unsung heroes. And unsung because... surprising, even in India today, they aren't very well known at all, and there were about 25 odd pundits. It's not clear how many there were because they weren't all recorded. But I think one of the things I try and point out in my book was that as much as explorers at the time during the 1800s, particularly explorers were really so well regarded through all of Europe, and they stood tall. And yet here were the pundits, which was a group of explorers, which are really, the world has never seen the likes of them. And they were certainly the greatest group of explorers that the world has seen. There's been many other famous explorers, whether it be Livingstone or Grant. You know, you can name many. And one of those pundits, for example, was awarded the Royal Geographic's Gold Medal, which was the pinnacle of exploration at the time. And his name and the name of many other pundits were known after they had finished their mission. So in this case, it was Nayan Singh. You know, and I think the other point I'd make there, and I've made when I've talked to Indians as well, is that I think any other country, you know, to have such an incredible group like that would be well known, you know, and there'd be a lot of, for example, statues and place names, etc., dedicated to them. And yes. And yet in India today, they're really not well known at all. It's actually only in the last couple of decades that their story has now started to be told again.
But you do introduce the reader to many exceptional characters who are involved in the great game. Who's your personal favorite player?
I think within that great game, perhaps a couple. One was Nayan Singh, and Nayan Singh went on to win the gold medal of the Royal Geographic Society. He went on a number of missions. I think it was four in all. You know, and by the end of it all, he was his health had suffered terribly, and he really was a spent force when he was retired. But also important because Nayan Singh was actually a school teacher up in the foothills of the Himalayas, and one translation of pundit is school teacher, and he was so successful that all the rest of the native explorers after him were named as pundits. They were, and he was quite an extraordinary person, but also because he really explored into Tibet as the first one, and I guess in a way blazed the pathway for the others that followed. So he was certainly an extraordinary explorer, and one of the few of the pundits that got the accolades he deserved in being recognized by the Royal Geographic Society. But having said that, you know, obviously many weren't.
Do you have a favorite among the English?
It's certainly William Lambton, who started the Great Trigonometrical Survey of India. And he was quite incredible because you know, he started the adventure in the 1800s, in 1800, and you know, was a self-educated geodist, and he had this dream of measuring the shape of the planet around India, and what he started later on, George Everest finished, you know, and had the mountain named after him. And between the two of them, when they finished, was called one of the greatest works of science, you know, in the whole history of science, which in itself was an incredible achievement. But he's my favorite again because from the British side, because he was self-educated, very humble, and focused on his work and in his science rather than on self-promotion or gathering wealth.
And by the time the Great Game was concluded in 1907, well, let me ask it this way. The Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907 is kind of the official conclusion of the Great Game. What is its legacy?
What is its legacy? I think perhaps, well, from my perspective, perhaps the greatest legacy was that it averted war. You know, on a number of occasions, Imperial Russia and Great Britain almost came to war, and these were the two big empires at the time. You know, they'd fought fought a war in Crimea, and that was so destructive. Then fighting over Central Asia and you know, within the machinations of the great game, on at least two occasions, you know, the world was predicting that they would go to war. But in the end, the Anglo-Russian convention, as you say, averted that war. And that in itself, I think, was quite an achievement. What was also important, of course, was that, you know, 7 years later, the Great War, the First World War, would begin, and those two empires, you know, needed each other as allies going into that First World War. So that was a very a very tangible benefit of the end of the Great Game, the legacy of the Great Game. There were many other political outcomes of that as well. You know, what happened in Tibet, what happened in Iran, and in Western Turkestan. But I think, yeah, I think the version of war was really important.
And by that time, had the entire globe been mapped, or was the job not yet finished?
I think with mapping, the job is never finished in some ways, because the technology just gets better and better. And so in a way, although the planet was mapped, and you see this all through the book, there were varying levels of accuracy. In an example being when India was first mapped, was mapped in a very, well, looking back, a crude way, with really low levels of accuracy, and as that's gone on all the way through to today, you know, when you have GPS, you know, mapping that takes you years now can be done with satellites, you know, and imagery, satellite imagery within hours or minutes. So I guess that mapping never stops.
Okay, that's fair. And of course, the globe also changes. In other words, what we have where, even though mountains and rivers don't generally change their location, the surface of the earth changes with what human beings produce and build and destroy.
That's absolutely right. And just if you look at the modern maps with showing climate change, the impact of climate change as an example, you know, it's really stark, isn't it? I mean, another example, yeah. If you go to Central Asia, you know, the Aral Sea today is nothing like what the Aral Sea looked like on a map in the 1800s.
Yeah, we don't usually think about the Earth changing that way, although right now it's in our face with climate change.
Yes.
Riaz, you've produced a beautiful work in mapping the Great Game. Are you considering a new project?
Yeah, yes, actually, my next book will be published at the end of this year, and it's about the Silk Road, and a lot about the very earliest maps on the Silk Road and how the Silk Road developed. I'm really looking forward to that, and all my efforts in the last couple of years have gone towards that.
Wow. Well, we wish you a lot of luck going forward. And we'll look, what's the title of the new book that we should look for?
Well, I have a working title at the moment, which is The Stone Tower on the Silk Road. And the Stone Tower was a famous landmark 2,000 years ago, which marked the midpoint of the Silk Road, but has since been lost in history, and a number of different historians and geographers have pointed to a place where they believe the Stone Tower was. And so what this book tries to do is perhaps pinpoint that Stone Tower through a whole lot of research and going back through the early histories and the early works of people like Claudius Ptolemy and the Chinese histories, which talked about the Stone Tower.
Sounds fascinating. I'll keep a lookout for it. Thank you so much, Riaz, for being on the show today, being generous with your time, and thank you for your important work.
Thank you, and thank you very much to your listeners as well, and anyone who's interested in not only the book but in the history and geography of that era and of that area.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.